The headlines: a string of blasts that hit southern and eastern Afghanistan, leaving at least 4 security personnel dead and 10 others injured. Venezuela's president hails the U.S. call for the lifting of U.S. and EU sanctions on the Latin American country, while the opposition blasts the report. Also coming up, former European Central Bank chief Mario Draghi is sworn in as Italy's new prime minister, following political tensions in the European country. Thanks for joining us. At least 4 security personnel have been killed and 10 others, including civilians, injured in a string of blasts in southern and eastern Afghanistan. Police say that 4 security forces, including a commander, were killed after an explosion in the Chabadar district of eastern Kunar province. Separately, an explosive-laden vehicle ripped through a police outpost in Kandahar province, injuring 7 personnel. And a roadside blast injured 3 civilians in eastern Nangarhar province. No group has claimed responsibility for the attacks, but Afghanistan has witnessed a rise in such assaults in recent days, with the government mostly blaming them on the Taliban. Violence surges despite ongoing talks between the militant group and the government to bring a lasting peace to the war-battered country. Massive inflation and unprecedented price hike has triggered violent protests in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
The clashes between the police and the government employees in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The security forces use excessive tear gas to prevent opposition-backed protesters who government fears could have besieged country's parliament. They demanded the government to raise their salaries by 40% to compensate them over massive price hike and inflation after Pakistan devalued its currency under an intense IMF pressure.
Tear gas and the lathi charge, that is really shameful because we are not terrorists. Our salaries should be increased, should be competitive, because when Imran Khan government took charge, inflation rate, you can see 300% inflation rate has been high and increased during the the previous 2.5 years, and we are still the PTI government has not increased even 1% our salaries in the last budget.
The protests by the government employees disrupted the usual official business across the country at a time when the mainstream opposition parties join hands against Prime Minister Imran Khan's government to oust him from power over alleged rigging in 2018's general elections.
We condemn the brutal violence in government employees. It is incredible to see such excessive use of force against the government employees. If they do not work in their offices, the government business would come to a grinding half. Will Imran Khan alone run the government?
Fearing the politicization of the protest, a better sense prevailed, and Prime Minister Imran Khan's government apologized with the protesting employees of the government and finally successfully negotiated with the leaders of the employees' union to end their protest. The government has announced to increase a 25% raise in their salaries. The troubles for the government are far from over. The mainstream opposition parties are all set to start a long march from all over Pakistan to capital Islamabad next month. However, with the end of the protest of employees, the government has managed to contain the crisis from being aggravated ahead of a long march. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
People in Myanmar have hit the streets for the 8th consecutive day to denounce a recent military coup amid growing anger over the arrest of activists. The rallies have been held in several cities, including the business hub Yangon. The protesters slammed security forces for raiding homes and detaining coup opponents. According to a political prisoners monitoring group, more than 320 people have been arrested since last week's coup. On Friday, the UN Human Rights Council adopted a resolution calling on the Myanmar's military to release all the detainees, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi, and hand power back to civilian administration. The military seized power over allegations that the November parliamentary, won by Suu Kyi's party with a landslide, was fraudulent. A UN envoy calls on the U.S. and the European Union to ease their sanctions on Venezuela, saying that the measures have worsened the humanitarian situation in the country.
The economy's decline started in 2014 with a downturn in oil prices. Among other factors reported to affect the economy of Venezuela, unilateral sanctions increasingly imposed by the United States, the European Union, and other countries have exacerbated the above-mentioned challenges.
Duhan said the unilateral sanctions have had devastating effects on the basic human rights of Venezuelans, including the right to food, health, life, and education. She said that the sanctions mainly affect those in extreme poverty. She called the existing humanitarian exceptions for Venezuela ineffective and insufficient. The UN envoy made the comments following a 12-day visit to the South American country. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro hailed the UN move and called the sanctions coercive.
Today, the rapporteur of the UN has called on the U.S. government and the governments of the European Union to review the sanctions and lift the sanctions against Venezuela because they have exacerbated this gigantic, enormous humanitarian crisis against the people.
The opposition leader Juan Guaido's UN envoy, on the other hand, criticized Doha's remarks as imprecise and a propaganda tool. The UN had previously called on Washington to lift its sanctions on Venezuela during the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. ambassador to Caracas, however, claims the economic crisis in Venezuela is due to its government's corruption. Commentator David Barkin says it is unlikely that the U.S. will ease sanctions on Venezuela despite calls from the UN.
Unfortunately, the Cold War notion of what's going on in Venezuela and the very, very strong economic interests of the United States and the desire on the part of U.S. Economic interests to take over the Venezuelan properties in the United States are militating against a softening of the regime in the United States with regard to Venezuela. I'm very pessimistic that Biden is going to make an about-face with regard to the sanctions regime in Venezuela.
The U.S. and China have been on a confrontational path over the past several years. The U.S. is now reviewing its strategy, but it will not be easy for the two sides to bridge their fundamental differences.
The world is curious about the future direction of the relationship between China and the United States. Tensions between the two major strategic rivals skyrocketed under former U.S. President Donald Trump. The former president seemed very proud of his tough line on the world's second-largest economy. He launched a trade war against China and blamed it for starting the devastating COVID-19 pandemic. Now his successor, Joe Biden, is still reviewing America's strategy towards its number one rival. This week he announced a Defense Department review of its China strategy as part of a broader effort to decide how his team will deal with Beijing. Now a newly formed task force at the U.S. Department of Defense will study the military strategy regarding China in different areas. Biden does not seem to have any illusions about the formidable challenges posed by the Chinese. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to lead an international effort to pressure, isolate, and punish China. This week, in his first phone call with the Chinese President Xi Jinping, Biden tried to press his counterpart on several issues, including trade practices, Hong Kong, and ongoing tensions with Taiwan. The American president underscored his fundamental concerns, but the Chinese president told his U.S. counterpart that he hoped Washington would approach matters of sovereignty and territorial integrity cautiously. She warned that confrontation would be disastrous for both sides.
There is a significant lack of trust on the part of both sides. Nobody's going to rush into anything at this moment under pressing conditions. But if they can find some individual items in which they can cooperate, COVID obviously is one of the areas which are affecting both countries.
China has repeatedly called on Washington to try to improve bilateral relations that deteriorated under the leadership of Trump. Will the new U.S. administration heed those calls for better ties? Well, the new occupant of the Oval Office has hinted that he is open to cooperation that will benefit the American people. The stakes can't be higher when it comes to the competition between the two global rivals. Any change in the Sino-U.S. relations could have an impact on the global economy and on geopolitical equations. But neither side seems willing to budge on key issues.
The United States has been trying hard to contain China in terms of economy and military power. Such efforts were intensified over the past years, but fulfilling that goal is proving to be increasingly difficult, with China's military might increasing and its economy expanding despite the pandemic that has battered the American economy. Some estimates show that China will overtake the U.S. and become the world's largest economy sometime in this decade. This is undoubtedly keeping the Americans on the edge. These concerns were echoed by U.S. President Joe Biden this week. During a meeting with a bipartisan group of senators soon after his phone call with the Chinese leader, Biden issued a stark warning. If we don't get moving, they're going to eat our lunch. Biden warned that the Chinese are investing very heavily to deal with a whole range of issues, including transportation and the environment. The American president said the U.S. just has to immediately step up infrastructure spending. How will Biden try to counter China? Is there any room left for cooperation? Chinese officials insist that there is still a possibility.
It's kind of a light at the end of what will probably be a very long tunnel if we are to repair the U.S.-China relationship. But I think that the statement made by President Biden in his foreign policy address, which was also pretty hard-hitting with regard to China, but nevertheless, he said that they will cooperate in those issues which are in the interest of the United States. And then, of course, the call on a very important, prior just to the a very important Spring Festival, I think sent a very good signal to the Chinese that maybe there was a way to create some kind of a new connection between the U.S. and China.
But will America move to reduce tensions? U.S. officials have said there would be no quick moves to remove tariffs on Chinese imports. The White House could even impose new targeted restrictions on sensitive technology exports to China. Experts say under Biden, the two sides will probably find a pathway to stabilize their relationship, but neither side will budge on key issues.
Italy's new prime minister has unveiled his cabinet picks after accepting the presidential mandate to form a government. Mario Draghi faces major challenges, including tackling the coronavirus pandemic, following the political crisis that forced the previous administration to step down. Our correspondent in Rome, Max Civilli, brings us more.
On Friday night, former president of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, formally accepted the Italian president's mandate to form a new government. This promises to put an end to a month-long political crisis that saw Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte resign after his coalition government collapsed in January. The new cabinet lineup proposed by Draghi, who played a pivotal role in steering Europe out of its sovereign debt crisis, is a mixture of veteran politicians and technocrats picked from across the political spectrum.
It's a difficult moment. The challenges are to defeat the pandemic, complete the vaccination campaign, offer responses to everyday problems, and relaunch the country.
I believe that the new cabinet is a high-profile one that can, on the one hand, reassure financial markets and, on the other hand, ensure stability. We pulled the plug on the previous government because Draghi is the best option for the country.
Draghi's broad-based government of national unity includes fierce political rivals who have agreed to put aside the differences for the time being. All the parties in parliament, except for the Nationalist Brothers of Italy group, have agreed agreed to back a drug administration. Even the anti-establishment five-star movement opted to support the new government after a divisive online vote among its members.
Under the new government, we expect the adoption of ruthless capitalist economic measures. Struggling companies won't be helped. I am afraid protests and disorders will be staged in Italy in the coming months.
The government of former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte collapsed amid criticism of his handling of the coronavirus pandemic and its paralyzing economic impact. That's besides political parties' reluctance to seize government control over 200 billion euros in grants and low-interest loans Italy is set to receive from the EU's COVID-19 recovery fund.
Draghi and his new cabinet are set to be sworn in by President of the Republic Mattarella on Saturday. Draghi's new government will likely face confidence votes in Parliament next week. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran's Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has rejected a claim by Britain, France, and Germany that Tehran is in breach of the 2015 nuclear deal. Zarif said Iran's activities are in line with paragraph 36 of the nuclear deal. He added that the three European signatories, or E3, have done nothing to fulfill their obligations following the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. Zarif was reacting to a statement by the European signatories in which they called on Iran to halt producing uranium metal. The E3 also urged Tehran not to take any non-compliance steps. After Washington's pullout of the deal, the Europeans had pledged to take steps to compensate for the loss and facilitate money transactions. The E3 have taken no serious measures in this regard, nearly 3 years after the U.S. withdrawal and its unilateral sanctions against Iran. Political commentator Tohid Asadi says the European signatories to the Iran nuclear deal are following the policy dictated to them by the U.S.
Well, I think the recent accusations we have heard from the European countries is the same trajectory that they have been following over the past 5 years. And we know that after JCPOA was signed and sealed as a Security Council resolution, we have received almost nothing from the European Union except for some verbose statements and some, let's say, lack of commitment. When it comes to European Union and European signatories of the deal, of course, they are basically following the same foreign policy trajectory and the same foreign policy, behavior that has been dictated by the United States to them. And this is something that Iran could not maybe tolerate anymore. Well, we know that from 2015, up until the moment that we're talking, patience is the name of the game that Iran has been practicing. So it might not be that much logical to expect Iran to implement further, patience considering the current situation.
And that is World News. It's bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18th, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The revolution came and brought full political independence for the country. That is to say, today in this vast world, there is not even a single power among the superpowers which can claim its will has the slightest effect on the will of the government officials or the Iranian nation. In particular, this issue, namely resistance, independence, political dignity, is the most attractive things for nations. When you notice that nations feel respect for the Iranian nation, you should pay attention to the fact that a major portion of this respect is related to our political independence. Monarchy was a system of government before the revolution. Democracy is the opposite of monarchy. In a monarchy, the people do not have any role in government. In a democracy, the people are in charge of everything. Government was hereditary before the revolution. Rulers used to determine their successors before they died. That is to say, the people had no role in government. Whether they liked it or not, they had no choice but to accept their government. Thanks to the revolution, the people can now choose their government. The taste and will of the people play a determining role. Before the revolution, the system of government was security-based dictatorship. Harsh and dark dictatorship. I remember that a friend of mine came to Mashhad from Pakistan to see me. He had entered the country illegally. He said that once he was sitting in a park with his friends and that they were reading a political leaflet in the park. I was surprised. Reading a political leaflet in a park? Is such a thing possible? I could not imagine that somebody could walk in the street with a political leaflet in his pocket. A leaflet which contains a few criticisms of the government. This was how the security-based dictatorship of that time was like.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today.
Africans have for decades been used for unethical clinical trials by large Western pharmaceutical companies in clear violation of their basic human rights. There have been many incidents of unethical experimentation, clinical trials lacking properly informed consent, and forced medical procedures in Africa. The clinical trial of the Pfizer drug Trovan in Nigeria is one of the examples. One of the victims harmed during a 1996 experiment in Nigeria by the U.S. pharmaceutical giant Pfizer elaborates on her suffering. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the long history of crimes committed by Western scientists and pharmaceutical giants in Africa. These crimes have come into focus amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Since the outbreak, there have been concerns that history will repeat itself and Africans or people of African descent will be used by Western pharmaceuticals to conduct unethical clinical trials for COVID-19 drugs and vaccines. So join us till the end of the show as our experts give you an in-depth analysis on this issue affecting hundreds of millions across Africa.
Pharmaceutical crimes in Africa. Western countries have a long history of illegal and unethical medical testing in Africa. Medical colonialism is a chapter of colonial history in Africa that was not closed and is again in the news amid the COVID-19 virus ravaging many countries in the world. Early April last year, Jean-Paul Mira, head of intensive care at Cochin Hospital in Paris, put forward the idea that tests for coronavirus vaccinations should be carried out in Africa, where he claimed there are no masks and no proper medical care. The research director at France's National Health Institute, INSERM, agreed.
Alors vous avez raison, et d'ailleurs on est en train de réfléchir en parallèle à une étude en Afrique justement pour faire ce même type d'approche avec le BCG, un placebo. Je pense qu'il y a un appel d'offres qui est sorti, il va sortir, et je pense qu'on va en effet sérieusement réfléchir.
This suggestion outraged the Director General of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom, himself an African from Ethiopia, who said that Africa will not become a testing ground for COVID-19 vaccines.
It was a disgrace, actually, and appalling to hear during the 21st century from scientists that kind of remark. And we condemn this with the strongest terms possible. But we assure you that this will not happen in Africa.
Clinical trials by Western pharmaceutical giants in Africa are not always conducted according to leading ethical guidelines. This puts clinical trial participants at risk of being physically harmed or having their rights violated. At the same time, excluding the continent from ongoing pandemic research is not the answer. Clinical trials can be ethically done, and many African countries and institutions now have ethics review boards to oversee medical research.
Amid reports that plans were afoot to conduct unethical COVID-19 vaccine trials in the country by Western research institutions, Kenyan president said that the country will only allow such trials if they follow internationally accepted protocols.
Once we have reached an area where these trials can be tested on humans, fellow Kenyans, as we have been briefing you on a regular basis, we shall keep you informed and we shall let you know, and nothing shall be done in the dark. You will be informed.
Now, for an incisive analysis on the unethical and criminal conduct of Western pharmaceutical companies in Africa, we are joined by Mustafa Traore, an academic, political analyst, and founder of AnOpenEye.org. We also have with us here Dr. Yurga Gelo-Waldeyes, a researcher and lecturer at the Curtin University's Center for Human Rights Education in Australia. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. And we start off with Mr. Gelo. Africa has, for over 100 years, been a testing ground for pharmaceutical companies from the West. They've been conducting unethical clinical trials for drugs. Now, clearly, medical experimentation is entrenched in the history of racism and colonialism. What's your take?
Thank you. I think that is true, because colonialism and racism is not simply the occupation of land and administering people and ruling them. For Africans, or generally for black people in particular, colonialism and racism has a particularly personal impact. They experience it in their body. So colonialism involves the colonization of the black body, the human body itself become a colonial property. Within that framework, colonial experimentations and the gathering of not just experimentation, but generally knowledge from Africans was conducted by treating the people as having no rights, no dignity or agency.
Thanks for that, Dr. Aguilo. Now, can you give us examples on how colonialists used unethical means to conduct medical experiments on Africans?
We can take examples, for example, from Namibia in the early 90s, where sterilization techniques were applied on Herero tribes. We can take examples of controlling African populations using contraceptives such as Iprovera in Zimbabwean women and also in Ghana. We can also take examples where Africans were given the agents that causes trypanosomiasis or sleeping sickness without their consent and knowledge. All of these examples tell us or show us that colonial knowledge or medical knowledge was collected from Africa without the consent, without the participation of the people, and in a way that also deprives the use of those medications or knowledge back to Africans.
Now, let's bring in Mr. Mustafa Traore. What's your opinion on unethical clinical trials by Western pharmaceutical companies on African people?
It seems that for some, in the past, black people, Africans, were the missing link between the monkey and human beings. So we know that scientists have always carried out experiments on animals first before trying the different medicines and on human beings. So this is why it has been the case for 100 years now, it's still going on. So we've got to be very vigilant with what's happening right now at the moment.
Mr. Traore says that Africans must be vigilant to stop global pharmaceutical giants from using them as guinea pigs. Back to you, Dr. Gelo. Even after the end of colonialism, Western countries, which claim to be champions of human rights, allow their pharmaceutical companies to conduct unethical trials on Africans. There appears to be no end in sight for these. Will this unfortunate trend continue?
That colonial exploitation was put into new systems. One good example could be the ways in which pharmaceuticals, for example, exercise a right of ownership over inventions that they acquire through experimenting on people.
The earliest reported unethical medical trials on Africans by Westerners were sterilization tests done on Herero women by German doctors. The Herero and Nama genocide was a campaign of racial extermination and collective punishment that the German Empire undertook in German Southwest Africa, now Namibia, against the Herero and the Nama people. It is considered the first genocide of the 20th century. It took place between 1904 and 1908. Despite being one of the richest countries in the world, Germany is yet to compensate the descendants of women who suffered unethical tests in the hands of German scientists during the colonial era. Why are Western countries refusing to take responsibility?
How can you understand that in France, you have people being paid to have babies, the government trying to encourage people to have babies, but at the same time, in some parts of France, because La Réunion is part of France, it's a kind of colony, you had people, or doctors, or scientists sterilizing women against their will. So there's something wrong here. So if we want to compensate, to repair what was done in the past, we've got to stop what we are doing right now.
The clinical trial of the Pfizer drug Trovan in Nigeria is cited as one of the outstanding examples of impunity by Western pharmaceutical companies in Africa. In 1996, Kano State in Nigeria suffered a major meningitis outbreak. Top United States pharmaceutical company Pfizer decided to conduct clinical trials to test a drug it was developing. Pharmaceutical crimes in Africa.
The drug had not yet been approved in the United States, where parents were not willing to put up their children as guinea pigs. Pfizer deliberately desisted from obtaining informed consent from the parents of the Nigerian patients. A Nigerian lawyer rejected the company's excuses that the studies were conducted through a deal with the Nigerian government.
At that time, the person, if there was any deal at all, was made by an individual against the interest of a government, against the interest of a nation. If you get what I'm saying? Now, forget about if any deal was done at all, it was individualistic deal. I don't want to hear about it. Pfizer ought to have known better. Can they do that deal in America? Can they do it in the UK or in any of the European countries?
Now, because of the adverse effects which the vaccine had on the children, including death and disabilities, the Nigerian federal government filed a suit against Pfizer and several of its employees in June 2007.
The government was seeking nearly $7 billion in damages for the deaths of children involved in the Trovan drug trial. In late January 2009, the Nigerian federal government informed the court that it has agreed with Pfizer to settle the lawsuit out of court.
We believe that the case that the federal government has against Pfizer is a good case. There's overwhelming evidence of Pfizer's misconduct. There's overwhelming evidence that Pfizer perpetrated all kinds of fraudulent activities and also engaged in this clinical trial illegally. There are victims who are living today. There are some families of the victims who have died who, what they understood at the time Pfizer came to Nigeria was that Pfizer was volunteering treatment. They did not think that they were volunteering their children as guinea pigs for a clinical examination.
In a move that surprised many, the parties agreed to a settlement figure of only $75 million. WikiLeaks cables suggest that Pfizer may have blackmailed the head of Nigeria's Ministry of Justice into dropping the multi-billion dollar criminal lawsuit. 24 years after the scandal, many victims are yet to be compensated and still can't live normal lives.
Back to you, Dr. Gelo. Do you think Western pharmaceutical corporations are taking advantage of poverty in some African countries by conducting unethical tests on their citizens?
They are not really poor. Poverty is not, lack of food or lack of shelter. That is destitution. Poverty is redefined as lack of what the West has. So how they operate is not because Africans are poor, but because they change the definition of poverty so that Africans will stop developing their own natural resources, will stop inventing what is relevant for them, will stop using their traditional and natural resources and knowledges to change their future, but instead wait for Western intervention to happen.
Thanks for that insight on destitution and poverty, Dr. Gelo. Now, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently raised concerns about the disinformation campaign and conspiracy theories circulating about COVID-19 vaccines.
While the country is in the process of procuring inoculations for its citizens as it fights the pandemic, anti-vaccine sentiments are being expressed by a number of people, including those in higher offices such as political leaders. Clearly, many Africans mistrust vaccines supplied by Western pharmaceutical companies, especially those that have a history of conducting unethical trials on Africans.
Dr. Gelo, is it true that incidents such as the Pfizer scandal in Kano, Nigeria, have led many to doubt even legitimate vaccines and thus negatively impacting on the overall health of the population?
That is a very good example what happened in Nigeria on Nigerian children who had meningitis by this big corporation raises the alarm that Africans are genuinely justified to doubt and are justified to ask strong guarantees, strong commitment that they will be beneficiaries. These experiences show us that there is no genuine desire to solve the problem of life, to solve the problem of Africans. The greatest drive is actually to acquire profit, to make more money. So there is a primacy of profit over the value of life. Within this context, then Africans are really justified to doubt.
Last year, there were protests in South Africa when the University of Witwatersrand, in partnership with the Oxford University, rolled out South Africa's first clinical trial. protesters said they did not want Africans to be used as guinea pigs, reflecting concerns among many in Africa over testing drugs on people who do not understand the risks.
I'm not happy at all. I mean, this feels like 1981 all over again, or in the 1980s all over again, when the AIDS pandemic just broke out in SA. It feels like the same thing. It's like a replay, but this time they're doing it in our face.
Mr. Traore, you earlier talked about vigilance in the face of unethical practices by Western pharmaceutical companies. Now, can you elaborate, especially in the context of the COVID-19 vaccine?
Keep on repeating it. Every bad thing that we do to African countries, okay, if it is accepted and if no one says anything, we are later going to do the same thing to our own population. So this is why we've got to be very vigilant, especially right now with the vaccines against COVID-19. Okay? So this is, we don't know what they have in their vaccines. We do not know. So I think, you know, when you have people in the world talking about reducing the population on Earth, you've got to be very vigilant.
In a very selfish move in June last year, the U.S. government bought up virtually all the stocks for 3 months of remdesivir, which has proven to work against COVID-19. This immoral and unethical decision by the U.S. left none for the rest of the world, including Africans who are involved in its clinical trials. Now, Dr. Gelo, we saw how the U.S. prevented African countries from obtaining remdesivir in the fight against COVID-19, yet Africans were used in its clinical trials. What's your view on this?
A lot of Africans from Liberia, from Guinea, from Democratic Republic of Congo were participating in experimental treatment for Ebola. So this medicine was administered to them, and it is by that participation, through that process, that this medicine became accepted as harmless for humans and can be used now for COVID-19. But what we see after all of this happened is the company that has sole ownership over this invention, the company called Gilead, has now is kind of exercising the right to give patent to selected companies and countries, and it is really unlikely that Africans will have easy access to this medication.
Mr. Traore, some Africans are skeptical about COVID-19 vaccines being sourced from Western countries. Is there a reason to doubt these vaccines?
I think this is the West, and everyone loves Africa, but they do not love the Africans. So Africans have to be very careful with that. They have to be aware of that. So this is why this is a crime. We know that when you've got some Americans talking about the fact that there are too many of us on Earth, that we should limit or reduce the population on Earth, we know that the first target is the African continent. This is where you have all the resources.
Mr. Traore there believes that some of these COVID-19 vaccines are actually a ploy to wipe out Africans. What do you think? You let us know through our social media handle. Now, Mr. Gelo, you get to have the last word in our show today. Tell us, what should African countries do to prevent Western pharmaceutical giants from using the continent as a testing ground for their drugs?
People have become, disposables if they are not useful for the system. That autonomy which we envision through various kinds of mechanisms such as human rights and others are not really being observed because governments are not observing the dignity of human beings. They are interested rather in protecting the profits, property rights, patent rights of corporations and companies. And governments which are meant to serve their own population, especially the poor, are not carrying out their duties in the way they are expected according to these international agreements of human rights that they signed up to. So I think we need to come back to the human, to our own human sense of dignity, a dignity that we give to life, and respect that life is more important than profit.
Well, life is more important than profit. We hope governments and global multinationals will listen to that advice and stop exploiting people for profits. And with that, viewers, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, I would like to thank you all, and until next time, goodbye and take care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
In the previous episode, we talked about how the Islamic Republic of Iran can actually be a model for other countries to follow, and how it is actually practically restoring the dignity and the respect of Muslims globally. Today, I would like us to talk about how this nation, Iran, is often at the top of the list of things to be talked about for the MSM, for the mainstream media, particularly the mainstream media of the Western powers. Why?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Because it challenges and puts under question the status quo. This is a short answer, right? Mm-hmm. The Islamic Republic has presented an alternative for the individuals of the world. What it has done is it has sparked that hope that we don't have to give in to the status quo. It has sparked that hope amongst nations, amongst individuals, that we don't have to put up with the bullying of the so-called superpowers. Mm-hmm. That is why Iran gets that level of attention. And how and why it has sparked that hope and that future for humanity? Because of Islam. Islam always had that potential. Mm. They just took that potential, the Iranians did, and of course the Islamic scholars. Mm. When we talk about Islam, it's not regional, it's not country-based. So are our scholars. They're not regional, they're not country-based. They are Muslims. They are Islamic, right? So the thought process is global, right? This is the very nature of Islam. When Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam came, he just did not come from Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula. If you look at the verses of Quran, it clearly says that he has come for the entire world, for the entire humanity, right? So hence, the Islamic scholars who are the inheritors of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, they have come for the entire humanity and entire world as well. Iran, because of its challenging the status quo, it gets that special attention in the world, especially amongst those who you can call are the think tanks of the world. Mm. They know that Iran has changed the equation, right? Let me take you 40 years ago, what was happening. About 40 or so years ago, the nations and the people had only one choice, and that was either join the United States of America or join the Soviets, mm-hmm. right? These were the two viable options, and the only choice they had was to pick and choose between one of the two, yeah. right? Iran came along, Islam came along, Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala alayhi, came along, the ideological, political Islam came along and alhamdulillah provided people with the third option. That you don't have to give in to these superpowers, so-called superpowers. They're fighting for their own personal interests, yes. Their greed. Mm. You don't have to do that. You have a third option, and that third option is the most viable option for you, and that is Islam. Iranians, they bought into the idea right away. And hence, the result is today we have an independent Iran, which is not dependent on the West, which is not begging in front of West. It is not looking for support for anything it does. You know, it is domestically producing things, you know, from knowledge all the way to the everyday commodities, right? It has the scientific power today to bring down the latest cutting-edge drone of America down from their airspace, you know, as soon as it enters Iran. You know, this is where it has gotten, right? You look at their satellites, you look at their nanotechnology, all of it, right? Why? Because they made a right choice when they were presented with that choice. The rest of the world is yet to come on board the way they should have.
And I would like to point out, Sheikh Ali, that when the Islamic Revolution was initially, you know, the initial sparks were taking place, the slogans of Imam Khomeini were picked up by Muslims across the Muslim world, in Iraq, in even the Hejaz, in other Muslim countries as well. They were also chanting death to America.
Yes, yes.
They were also, you know, chiming those same sentiments.
Yeah, one of the great observations, if you go back in time, when the Islamic Revolution came, right at that time, if you look at Pakistan, for instance, right, which is a neighboring country to Iran, the slogan of death to America was one of the, and it today is too, but I'm talking 40 years ago when nobody else was on board. Dr. Muhammad Ali Naqavi, he's a shaheed, he's a martyr. He raised that slogan, and the youths of Pakistan were recognizing who the enemy of humanity is, who the enemy of this region is, and who the enemy of Muslim nations is. So they were chanting death to America back in the day. I'm talking like 1979, right? They were chanting it. So absolutely right, spot on.
So, and you can actually tell that from that point, the amount of propaganda that has increased against particularly Shiism and Iran, like even in the last 10 years, if you compare it to the 30 years before that, it has significantly increased.
Right, and there's a reason for that, right? So the revolution was introduced. Imam Khomeini said, okay, this is a new path. This is that third option that I talked about. So it disturbed the equation of the status quo. Now, America was hoping that this revolution that has come about just recently, it is going to fall apart. Why? Because these scholars, these Islamic scholars, these fuqaha, they don't know how to run a country. You need experience. You need to have like proper literature. You need to have like, they don't know a jack, right? So they're going to fall.
They said, give
they're
it a few,
collapse.
Give it a week.
Yes.
Then they said,
so
give
this
it a
is
month.
Where they started, right? They said that by tomorrow evening, that system is going to fall. The system of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic, the new, fresh born Islamic Republic, an infant, a baby, right? It didn't happen. Then they're like, okay, give it a week. Then, and these are the official statements, by the way. We're not just making it up. These are the official statements of the officials of the United States of America at that time, namely Carter and his administration. And then they're like, give it a week. Then they're like, give it a month. Then they're like, okay, by next, you know, I don't know, Christmas, next summer. They're still doing it. You know, the most recent thing was with the Munafiqeen-e-Khalq, the MKO, they call themselves Mujahideen-e-Khalq, housed in the West because they escaped Iran after getting proper beating, and they went in hiding, and the refuge of MKO turned out to be the West, right? Naturally. So the most recent is, I believe in 2019, it was said, or 2018, 19 I think it is, right? John Bolton on MKO conference, he comes out in public and he said that we've got all the groundwork done. This Christmas, this year's Christmas, we are going to have in Tehran, right?
Yeah, I remember that now.
Now, this has been on their wish list from day one of the revolution, right? They work towards it, and they're still hoping for it, right? Then they said, this year, Iran is going to have a hot summer, right? It was an official statement by the United States of America, right? Which means there are going to be riots, and there are going to be, like, disturbance, civil disobedience, and people are going to stand up against the system and the government and the leadership, and they're going to do a coup, in other words, right? This is what the statement meant. Guess what? Allah turned it around for them. Now, America not only had a hot summer, but a very cold winter as well. You're looking at Capitol Hill as we speak,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
people are storming in, people are burning things, policemen are being shot, and there are like mass protests throughout the United States of America. I was looking at a chart where they said what roads of Washington are blocked.
Wow.
Literally, they had like red dot on every alley.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you call a curfew. Right. But the world, of course, is not going to talk about it because the mainstream media, as you pointed out, is in the hands of these oppressive powers. They're funding it. They're controlling it. They're threatening the journalists, anybody who is genuine, who is, who comes out and speaks up the truth. They are given a shut up call by just, you know, firing them from job and stuff. So you're not going to see much of it in the mainstream media. But the world knows it. The world is seeing it. Right. Those who are informed, they're seeing it. So alhamdulillah, you know, Iran is standing tall and America is collapsing. The regime is, this administration is on its way out, but the regime is collapsing. This pharaonic regime is collapsing. And this is a good news for all those justice seekers and the oppressed around the globe.
Syed Mahdi, why is Iran always at the top of their list of things to talk about?
One of the reasons that they, you know, have decided to attack Iran, to attack the Islamic Republic, and the reason that it's at the top of their list, one of them is, like we had said, that it presents the Islamic model. It presents the most accurate, the most perfect, the clearest manifestation of the Islamic model, right? The Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution is based upon Islam, pure Muhammadan Islam. And so it is in reality the purest Islamic model that can be seen out there. So you see a lot of, so-called governments out there who claim to be Islamic or Muslim governments when in reality they are not following this pure Islamic model. And this is why they're failing in a lot of their aspects. And so if we say that this is an Islamic model, Islam is the design for the perfection of the world, right? The Islamic model is the design for the perfection of the world. It was given to humanity by Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, via the infallible messenger of Allah. And it has been protected by the infallible imams and the ulama, the religious scholars that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So this Islamic model, you ask, is that what does this Islamic model stand for? And again, it is because of all these reasons that they are attacking and the Islamic Republic is at the top of their list. Islam stands for independence and freedom, self-determination, equality, justice, truth, prosperity, material and spiritual benefits, social justice, economic justice, ridding the world of discrimination and racism and prejudice. These are all the things, and these are just some of the things which Islam stands for and Islam wants to promote. These are universal values. These aren't values which are specific to any country or any tribe or any ethnicity. All of humanity believes in these values and wants to implement these values. And these are Islamic values, of course. And in today's time, you see that people are looking towards Islam. And Islam, in the manifestation of the Islamic Republic, this model, this system, and the Islamic Republic is showing this new model to the world, this perfect model, which can do better than any and all of these other flawed and broken systems which are prevalent in the world today. And so this is why they are attacking the Islamic Republic of Iran.
I mean,
among
that makes
many
sense
reasons.
Because they have their own ideas of what justice and freedom and independence actually are. I mean, obviously America's ideas of all these things are all not only flawed, but they're actually, you know, they backfire against themselves. So in the name of democracy, they kill democratic leaders. In the name of freedom, they steal the freedom of people in their own country and abroad as well. In the name of, I don't know, independence, they have made every other country dependent on them.
Right.
And upon their system. So if there's another country out there which is, you know, screaming out and saying that there is actually another way of looking at all of these things,